My name is Karen Johnson, and I'm the staff coordinator at Holden and also intern from Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Columbus, Ohio. This is the first session that I've given at Holden, and I'm glad that you're here to walk through this experience together with me and look forward to your response and your participation. Yesterday, I'll be talking today about Luther's political ethic as found, as he expressed in his doctrine of the two kingdoms. Yesterday, when I left breakfast, I met a friend at the door, and he said to me, "What are you going to do today?" And I told him that I would be preparing for today's session. And he asked, "Oh, what are you going to be teaching?" And I told him Luther's political ethic as found in his two kingdom doctrine. And he wrinkled up his nose and made a face like he had swallowed something horrible. And he said, "That doesn't even sound good to eat." And I laughed and appreciated his humor and his comment, and then went home yesterday to work on this session. And the more I worked on the session, I realized how appropriate his statement was, because Luther's political ethic has been very distasteful to many people. It's a very controversial, complex issue, which has often been misinterpreted, and also Luther at times lent himself to this misinterpretation. Some of the people who did not appreciate Luther's teaching in this regard were Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was hanged in 1945 in Germany, a Lutheran theologian. He said that Luther's teaching, his political ethic, reduced New Testament ethics to a morality of quietistic innerworldliness. Karl Barth, another well-known theologian, said that Luther's teaching was the fountain of Hitlerism. And Niebuhr said that this teaching was perverse and tyrannical. So that's some pretty strong language used toward Luther in this regard. On the other hand, you have equally well-known theologians, Althaus and Abeling being two of them, also Berggrav, the bishop in Norway, Lutheran bishop in Norway in 1941, who defend Luther's political ethic and say that it leads to social participation, social responsibility. So by this brief introduction, you can see that we're really getting into some difficult material here, and we'll just take it step by step. And my hope is that when we're done with the hour, that we just begin to struggle together with part of our Lutheran heritage. In discussing this, first, before doing that, Luther's political ethic. What does that mean? Three words, but they sound confusing. Here, Luther is talking about the appropriate role of the church in society. How do we live out our lives daily in the world? How do we be faithful Christians in our daily walk through life? What are the moral obligations of Christians towards specific issues? Do we have moral obligations when it comes to government and society? These are the questions that Luther is addressing. It is important to look at the historical perspective out of which Luther's thought grows. He lived in the 16th century in Germany, and this was the feudal system. There was a hierarchy from the nobility at the top down to the serfs at the bottom. And you were born in one slot, and that's where you stayed throughout your life. He lived under the benevolent, supportive rule of Frederick the Wise. Luther could not imagine a revolt. He thought that this would lead to utter chaos throughout the land. He did not know anything about a democracy such as we know now. He sees the state and society as part of nature, as part of God's created order. And therefore, it's good. It was created by God to combat sin and to keep at bay the forces of chaos in the world, the forces of good and evil. In the medieval context, even if a bad ruler were in power, that was by God's will, and thus it was not to be revolted against. Government for Luther is like your skin. You just can't take it off and put it back on again when you choose to do so. It's there and it remains there. Luther also believed that the nation was fundamentally a Christian nation.
Any nation?
The nation that he lived in.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. Initially, his two kingdoms doctrine, his political ethic, was a response to his setting. First of all, he said that the church and the state had confused their appropriate authorities. He said that the church was meddling in state affairs and that the state was meddling in church affairs. And I'll quote from Luther. The bishops and secular authorities had neatly put the shoe on the wrong foot. They rule the souls with iron and the bodies with letters, so that the worldly princes rule in a spiritual way and spiritual princes rule in a worldly way. Bishops, instead of preaching the word, were busy making money, buying land, building castles, and the princes were busy ruling the souls of people. And Luther said that this was really backwards. So he attempted to sort this out through his two kingdoms doctrine. This was one of the reasons that he developed this doctrine. Also, Luther was railing against the idea during that time that the Roman Catholics had toward the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' teaching, and also on the other hand, what the Anabaptists were saying about Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount. The Roman Catholics said that these teachings of Jesus were only for those very perfect people, a very elite group of Christians, that they were really the only people that could perfectly obey Jesus' commandments. And these were the monks, the people that removed themselves from society and went away to monasteries and tried to live out in every detail Jesus' teaching. Roman Catholic Church said that the common ordinary folk really couldn't do all of these things and that they were counsels from Jesus to us and that we could try to live them out, but that we really weren't expected to obey them to the full extent. That was Roman Catholicism on the one hand. On the other hand, you had the Anabaptists. And these people also said their interpretation of the Sermon on the Mount was that no, it's impossible that the situation in the world and Jesus' teaching just can't be intermingled. They can't be brought together while we are a part of this world. And therefore, we too must withdraw from society. We must pull apart and not participate in government and society. And Luther said no to both of these extremes and said that Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount was meant for everybody, no matter if you were a monk or a serf or whatever you did, but that we were really all asked to try to fulfill out these teachings in our daily lives. So this was another reason that he developed his two-kingdom doctrine, his political ethic. Finally, Luther was responding to the attack he was under from the Roman Catholic Church at that time. In 1522, Luther was excommunicated for his teachings, and anyone who followed him was also threatened, actually, with imprisonment and death. And the church had said no to several things at that time, which Luther and the reformers were trying to institute. Luther had translated the Bible. The Catholic Church said no to this. Also, Luther encouraged communion in two kinds, both the bread and the wine, rather than one. Also, Luther said yes to clerical marriages. This was outlawed. No, priests could not be married. Also, Luther wanted to do away with some of the liturgical vestments, all of the gold and the silver and the very fancy things, and to get back to some simplicity. Once again, the church said no to this. And Luther's books were all banned. People were not supposed to even own them, much less read them. So the people were threatened by execution for listening to Luther, for following him. And so they asked Luther, what are we supposed to do? Romans 13 says, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those who exist have been instituted by God. So the people were asking Luther, do we obey Romans 13, or do we follow you and your reforms? Luther had a safety valve, and that was Acts 5, verse 29. And the apostles answered, we must obey God rather than human beings. Luther responded to the people's question about civil disobedience, should they really break the law and follow Luther, with his writing in 1522. It was titled, Temporal Authority, to what extent should it be obeyed? This is the two kingdoms doctrine found herein, in temporal authority. And it's Luther's answer as to how we live in the world as Christians. Once again, keeping in mind the setting that I told you about before, the feudal government system. Luther's thought grows out of Augustine. Augustine died in 430. Augustine was probably the first Christian philosopher. And he wrote about history. And this can be found in his book, City of God. And in this book, Augustine has a very pessimistic view about history and the world. And he talks about the conflict between God, the realm of God, or the city of God, and between Satan, the city of Satan. So it's kind of an upper and a lower level between the two. Luther had this dimension to his two kingdoms doctrine as well. But he developed it beyond Augustine. Luther's thought also grows out of Paul and Romans 13, what I just read to you about obeying the governing authorities. Luther believed that a political authority was a gift from God, and once again that this gift from God was for our human good, to keep order in the world. Luther recognized that we lived in a fallen world, and he felt that God gave us government to keep us from really destroying one another. The two kingdoms is a twofold rule of God. And I think it will help to look at the blackboard now, if you can read that. The pens are running out of ink, so it's a little bit hard to write there. But it helps to keep that in mind and to look at that as we go along from now on. It's a twofold rule of God. God rules in both realms, kingdoms, realms. I'll use the word interchangeably. He rules in the left with his left hand and the state, and God rules in the right with his right hand and with the church. Once again, Luther develops this theory as a way of saying how we as Christians can respond to social concerns and government and justice issues. It's important to keep in mind that for Luther, both of these realms are established by God. And God works in both of them through people. In the left, we find the temporal authorities, in other words, the government, the civil government, which is a gift from God and is an expression of God's loving concern for us, for our human good. Just God created the government, just as God creates mothers through which to feed infants, or food can be given to us through farmers. Education comes to us through teachers. Healing comes to us through doctors and nurses and the medical profession. And order is kept in our society through the government. This is how Luther looked at the government. In the right, across from the temporal authorities, we have the spiritual authorities, the church. Word and sacrament. This is the gift of the gospel. As it is preached, it grows in within the hearts of believers and produces trust and nurture. And the reason for the order on the left hand, the government, is to keep order so that the gospel may be preached. The basic function found within the left hand kingdom is reason and law. reason through the mind and law to keep the order. Faith functions basically in the right-hand realm. However, Luther said that there was a distinction between these two kingdoms, or these two modes of rule of God, that he never wanted there to be such a separation between them, that there was no longer interaction between the two. He wanted there to be a constant tension going back and forth between the law and the gospel, between order and the word and sacrament. Unfortunately, it even looks confusing to have it up there. Even the title, I think, Two Kingdoms, is misleading and leads to a separation with the Two Kingdoms doctrine. Government, Luther said, is for the sake of keeping equity among all people, and this is produced or done through reason and law. He again felt that we needed order in society to prevent chaos in the land. Also, in the left-hand kingdom, he includes not only civil government, but he included marriage, family, all social structures, owning of property, economics, all of these social orders, so that it wasn't just civil government, but he felt that God had provided other structures for us to live in society. And he felt also that the Christian had the right and the duty to serve in government, that we were placed in this world and that we should serve wherever we might be. Once again, he felt there was a need for constant interaction between these two manners of God's rule, that they should never be distinctly separate. Luther felt that God's two modes of rule have but one goal, and that is the fulfillment of the promise made in the gospel of the kingdom of God. With Jesus came a new age, with Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. And in this new age, it was the breaking in of the kingdom of God, and in this new age can be seen the values of the kingdom: shalom, peace, wholeness, well-being, community, harmony throughout the created order. And this was what Luther had said: until that fulfillment comes in the future, we are in this state now, and we witness to the fact that the kingdom has already broken in with Jesus Christ by living in the world and pursuing the things that Jesus Christ pursued. As I mentioned, Augustine really is where Luther got his initial thought about the Two Kingdoms doctrine, with the difference with the city of God and the city of Satan. And that was one dimension of Luther's teaching. There were two other dimensions, and that was of church and state, as we see here. And also Luther had a dimension which he called for me and for others. When it came to something for me, if I were attacked, then I would suffer that, just as Christ had suffered it. Luther was not at all for me, myself, and I, or me as being number one. When it came to that, he felt that selfishness was so ingrown within us that we really needed to have something such as this doctrine, as the Two Kingdoms doctrine, to remind us always that we do not come first, but we rather should be as Christ was and suffered as Christ did. However, when it comes to others, then Luther felt that, yes, we could resist and do what needed to be done for the sake of others. Once again, this is where a lot of trouble comes in with Luther's doctrine, because it makes it sound like we live in a divided ethic, that at one time we're supposed to act one way, and at another time we're supposed to act another way. And that leads to a great deal of confusion. I think there are several positive things about Luther's doctrine, about his political ethic, and that is that he has fully incorporated the theology of the cross. Luther has no illusions about our natural nature. He feels very much so that we live in a fallen world, and he recognizes this by saying that we need order and government in order to prevent us from really destroying one another, and from the strong getting stronger and the weak getting weaker. Lord, also another positive about this theory is that Luther sorted through the confusion between church and state. However, this led to a negative, because in time there was a very definite separation between church and state, though I don't think this is what Luther originally intended. I think he wanted us to live in both, for Christians to serve in government as well as to live the Christian life, but to live the Christian life while serving in government. Perhaps one of the most positive things is that in this theory, Luther gave people a sense of vocation in all of their lives. Prior to this time, only the clergy, the priests, were those people who had a real sense of vocation. These were the churchly people, and this was the real special calling. But Luther was saying that every one of us in our daily lives has a vocation, that no matter where we are, if we're in the home, if we're at work, wherever that might be, on the farm or serving in some political office, that this is our sense of calling, and that we are to live out our Christian faith right there where we are. So that this doctrine of the two kingdoms is very closely tied with the priesthood of all believers, that we are all priests under Christ. But then we have the negatives, and I think these stand out more than the positives, especially throughout history, and we can see what this theory of Luther's has come to be in time throughout history. First of all, rather than seeing the left and the right hand as seeing a distinction between them with constant interaction, there has been a wall that has been placed right between the two, and we have made compartments out of the two different areas. There's a tendency to emphasize the distinction between the right and the left hand. And thus this produces more of a quietistic attitude. And this is what Bonhoeffer and Barth were talking about when they said that Luther was the fountain of Hitlerism. They felt that the Lutheran Church throughout the world at the time of Hitler said, well, that's a matter not for us to respond to politically, but rather that we're supposed to respond to matters of faith. Also, racism is another charge that has been brought against Luther, that once again people felt, well, that's not a spiritual matter, so that we should not respond to that. We should not take initiative to try to change wrong when we see it, but just to kind of let the authorities go, that the authorities are in charge. So we tend to separate, or the tendency has been to separate religion on the one hand and politics on the other. And in this way, religion becomes a private affair. Faith becomes a private matter. And faith is never a private matter. It always extends out to others. At the top, I've written God's love. Everything proceeds from God's love. At the bottom, I've written Christian's response is love. That's our love is active, our faith is active in love, and love is active in seeking out justice on behalf of all people. And this can't happen when religion becomes a matter between me and God and doesn't reach out into the world in all that we do. Also, I mentioned previously, one of the negatives is the division of our Christian ethic, saying that we behave one way at one time and another way at another time. And that's just too hard to sort out. And one final negative is that it leads to sometimes to defeatism. In other words, well, the authorities are in control and there's nothing I can do, things are so bad, so that really I don't need to try to change anything. I would say that the two kingdoms doctrine is really not useful for our own day. And again, we need to look back at the setting where Luther has a high opinion of government offices and a very conservative opinion about society, about human beings. He says that we need government to keep the beasts under control and not to expect much change from people. Also in Luther's day, there was much less possibility for an orderly change of government, and he had a horror of the mob uprising because he really felt that this would lead to such chaos. It's very difficult to transport to our day Luther's teaching of the two kingdoms doctrine. Therefore, I think we need to squeeze out of it the principles behind it all. And I think it's an historical expression of Luther's call for radical faith in daily life. And I think this is exactly what happened in the Reformation. The reformers demanded and brought about radical change. The Reformation was a decisively political act. They did go against the authorities. But it's what Luther thought, and the reformers, was the best thing to do, something that had to be done. The question for us then, for all of this, is what does reason and faith, both the left and the right hands, what does faith call us to do today in society? And then when we discover what that is in our daily lives, then to act boldly on behalf of others. I'd like to read a quote from an ALC document written in 1970. It's titled Sent Into the World. The gospel does not abandon some dimensions of life and speak to others. It addresses the whole world of relationships, personal, family, community, economic, national, and international. To that, I ask then, what do we say to political matters and social concerns? Should we, as the Lutheran Church, be more like the moral majority? Do we really have a bone to pick with them as far as their being involved in political action? Or is it rather more that we beg to differ with the theology, and that maybe the moral majority can set an example for us, for example, of being involved in political affairs? How do you respond to some of this? Should we as Christians, first of all, not just in our own lives, individuals, take a political stance, but also as the corporate church, take a political stand?
Yes.
And would you like to develop that more, whoever said yes?
I said yes, I don't know. I think we should be a stand individually as congregations and also as a national organization.
Mm-hmm. Can you give some examples?
Yeah, I can think now on cutting back on, I don't like to call it welfare, cutting back on the payments to those who happen to find themselves in need at this particular time in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Support their support.
Mm-hmm.
I've got lots of opinions, probably too many.
Uh-huh.
Why don't I just leave it at that?
Okay. Thank you. Good. Others of you, do you think we should be so politically involved that it may well at times lead to civil disobedience? How do you respond to that?
Mm-hmm. I firmly believe in the separation of church and government. For example, during the Vietnam War,
mm-hmm.
there were a lot of people that felt that draft evaders and so forth, those people that were marching, was a violation of our Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Others felt that this was right because we shouldn't have been there in the first place. Therefore, there was a division in our church sometimes. And I don't think there should be a division in the church. The mission of the church is to propagate God's word, not to form factions. And I think that's what it develops into.
You do. How do some of... I see a hand in the back. Thank you.
I think we have to identify God's word. What is it? It's more than our own salvation.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, the church should have room for people of different opinions. If there are factions, so be it. There's something above all the factions anyway. You still have a unity of purpose. You can still have your own ideas. With a trident, we certainly are split down the middle in our congregations and many issues we are.
Mm-hmm.
There should be room for these differences.
Mm-hmm.
Karen, one point concerning back to Vietnam for a moment. The best argument against going to the war there, even if one were not connected with the religious group, was the Nuremberg trials. We said to those Germans we put to death that there is a matter of conscience that is much higher than any Romans 13 obeying the legal authorities. And this has been one that's always been touched on, but that's one where I think secular religious people can occasionally join Thomas Jefferson and Luther influence the Nuremberg trials in their own quirky fashions.
Thank you, Jim. I would like to read just a short quote from George Farrell's book, The Christian Lifestyle. And he talks about this separation, or I think he is talking about the separation of church and state here. He's responding to people who say, that's a matter for politicians. That's not a matter for us as Christians. We don't need to be concerned. In our time, whenever the church in assembly says a word about peace or justice, some politician who doesn't happen to agree with the position taken will claim that the church should only speak about the life to come, and that politicians alone have the right to make pronouncements about the affairs of this world. It is obvious that the personal political opinion of a clergyman or woman or any other Christian is just that, and as valid as the personal political opinion of a lawyer, a football star, a nuclear scientist, or a parking lot attendant. In other words, Farrell is saying that we need to be involved so that our faith doesn't become a matter of just being a private affair. Way in the back, there's a hand.
Right, we come back to the fact that the government is us. This is smart. This is the unique country. There are there are so many injustices, like prisons and a lot of things that I think that the Christian should just say that they can't get involved is not Christian.
What happens to our government, for instance, if Christians do not get involved? Doesn't it become dehumanizing? Why are we willing to allow the government to be run by people who don't hold some of the values that we hold?
You don't vote for them.
Well, in the earlier history of our country, there was the strong idea that if you're a Christian, you didn't get involved. So the robber barons took over and just did their own thing.
I would like to, yes, John.
I guess I'd like to go back to a clarification of, you said that Luther was misunderstood. He wanted a constant, and you even had the going back and forth, just a constant back and forth, and we have built a wall. Would you give what Luther saw as, how did he see it working? Let's take Vietnam. Let's take an issue like Vietnam, and whether or not the church as church should have been in on either protest or opposition to the war, or should have remained as saving souls, or I don't want to prejudice it, but staying with what people would have said were more spiritual things. Can you put Luther into that discussion from what he's written or not? What would you see?
Okay, that's what. When I first started studying this, that's what I tried to do.
Okay.
And several professors would say, Fred Moyser, for instance, would say that's impossible to remove Luther from his historical setting. Therefore, we need to squeeze out of Luther the basic principles, but not to try to lift this whole system of the right and the left into our day and apply things such as Vietnam to it right now. That's why I think it is no longer really a very helpful doctrine as it stands. That it is so tied to the feudal system of government with the hierarchy and the serfs, the nobility at the top, and being born into a certain class.
See, my assumption is that what this gentleman said is the opinion of a lot of people who think they are Lutheran and who are saying the church should have continued to preach the gospel and lead worship services and have catechism and maybe send chaplains over for the spiritual welfare of those who had to fight. But God will somehow work through our government to make the right decision in regard to whether we stay in Vietnam or not stay in Vietnam. And think that's Luther's doctrine of the two kingdoms being brought into a current situation. I mean, I think a lot of people would say, and you're saying that's not a correct use of it?
No, I'm saying that it's not a correct use. Okay. That Luther didn't ever draw that solid line, but that his idea lends itself so well to being separate, to having the church and the state as separate matters. But Luther insisted and encouraged people to be involved in government. He said that there should be Christian princes, for instance, and he gave them precepts as to how to live and how to rule. He even said that if one was called to be a hangperson for the government, that a Christian should do that. That's the extent that he said we should be involved in government. And that these were just ways of God ruling with both the right and the left hand, and therefore, obviously, they couldn't be separated. And that God ruled through people in both of these areas, in both the church and in the government.
It strikes me that as he has a picture, he has an ideal situation, pictures where the right and the left are interacting with each other so that you have a government which is trying to do the right things according to what the church would want them to do. Well, they obviously don't have that type of situation. We never have and probably never will in this world. But, and you said he used that escape valve. You know, the Acts 5, to say that, you know, there are times when you have to draw a line and you have to say the state is exceeding the authority that it has, and it is starting to conflict with my faith. And I think that, you know, that I think is perhaps a way that we could take a look at it. I don't know whether Luther would have agreed with me, but it seems like you have to look at it in that type of light. I mean, how can you even justify the war by Romans 13. I mean, there are two countries fighting. Both are temporal authorities provided in the world by God. Both would be right. You couldn't fight.
Right. I think what Luther is asking us to do is he's asking for a radical call to faith, wherever we might find ourselves, in whatever situation. And again, I think the Reformation itself is an example of that. Luther did break the law. He did go against what the government said. So that is an example of where he crosses the line between church and state.
Wouldn't he have to do that to a certain amount, seeing that most of the feudal lords and whatnot were also either a bishop or a cardinal and were tied in directly with the center of the ruling church, and they also rule the people say at the same time. It's pretty hard to say, well, he's going to take it out of his left hand and put it into his left hand and right hand, because it's he's talking to a different person. Then that bishop is going to be the same whether he's talking one way or the other. He's not going to divide himself each time he talks. And it did make a condition whereby that the complete revolution, as you might say, at that time was necessary to make people realize that they were the church as well as the bishop and the cardinal. You have to have all of the people being of that mind, and if they don't teach them that, they weren't going to allow people to read this stuff even when it was written. It was against the law. And that Luther's time was against the law to read what he wrote, say nothing about what all these other reformers wrote. And if they could read, they would get a little page, they didn't get his whole writings. And it's kind of hard to equate a total separation of government with the church on such ragged happenings. So there's many happenings down through the time, and each time they had to come up with an interpretation of the cover, what they were trying to prove. So,
yes, indeed. Many of the princes were also spiritual leaders or rulers at that time as well. But then, again, Luther was railing against the fact that the church was just acquiring so much money, so much land, and building castles, and really spending so much time doing those kinds of things. And then the state was making edicts about the salvation of souls, spiritual matters, as Luther called them. So they were kind of, as he said, putting the shoes on the wrong foot. But now again, that's to say there needs to be constant interaction. But we, in each of these areas, the church, the basic function again is the work of faith and preaching the gospel. And in the state, that's to keep order so that the gospel may be preached.
Mm-hmm. I'll have to pose a personal question. Hypothetical. Uh-huh. You have two boys. Mm-hmm. One is a conscientious objector, religiously. Okay. Uh-huh. The other one feels that he owes something to his government. Mm-hmm. Now, you're going to counsel these two boys. Mm-hmm. What are you going to tell them?
I would first have them examine and express their own values, what they're both feeling, and why one would choose to be a conscientious objector, and why the other would choose to serve the country, in whatever fashion that would be. And someone else here has a response, I think, to you that's fuller than that. You have your hand up.
Both of them could be trying to serve the country.
Pardon?
Both of them could be trying to serve the country. The conscientious objector might, you know, they're serving the country better by that, because they're trying to really reorient what the country is trying to do and make it a better country. You don't have to serve in the army to be to serve the country. There is also alternative service too that many conscientious objectors took, which also served the country, but it was not in war because they could not, by their faith, accept fighting or even serving as a medic for so that other people could fight. And there's many, many ways that people can serve the country, and many people who oppose actions that the country is doing, even to the point of civil disobedience, do it out of a great love for the country, not because they don't love the country.
Thank you. That makes me think of the movie last night. Did any of you see Ground Zero at Bangor? Or how many of you did? If not last night, how many saw it previously? Okay, that was a movie about the peaceful protest against the Trident submarine in Bangor, Washington, over on the coast. And John Nelson, Lutheran campus pastor at Washington, the University of Washington, said something very similar to that. He had spent some time in jail because of trespassing in protest against nuclear weapons. And he said about the government, someone asked him this question, do you feel you're not supporting your government? And he responded, this civil disobedience on my part is an act of care for my government. It's not rebellion against the government. In other words,
I appreciate some of the demonstrators' ideas and John's and Nelson's thoughts, but somehow I don't go along with him breaking the law in order to accomplish his thoughts. Mm-hmm. I think he went too far. I'm not with him.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Other responses? There's the hand.
Well, I can't see what the reason for objecting to the means or mode of that particular submarine, because it happened to be a nuclear device that's running it. If a diesel engine is running that, it'd be the same weapon. Why object to that? If they look positive and says, we object to weapons per se, or that we object to gasoline or diesel or whatever it is, to running an engine of war.
All right. Roxy has her hand up in the back.
Yeah, sometimes I think that we don't understand what they're doing, and so we don't really know what they're thinking. I mean, to climb over the fence to Trident is the same thing as to sit at the lunch counter if you're black. And maybe sitting at the lunch counter is more clear, but it was certainly as serious to the black people to sit in the front of the bus, go swimming in the swimming pools, and sit at the lunch counters as it is to the pastor who climbed over the fence along with the 300 others that climbed over the fence. And he's trying to make the symbolic statement to get your attention to the fact that these things are first strike weapons. They are terribly accurate. You don't make an accurate weapon to hit an empty silo in Russia. You make an accurate weapon to hit a full silo in Russia. And so, I mean, it's a new idea. It's a new thing. It's even different from protesting in the Vietnam War. And our government wasn't lied to us during the Vietnam War. And some of us really went into the war hoping that it would solve the problem of the communist takeover of that country. We really thought that's what was going to happen, and it didn't happen. They did it anyway, you know. And whether we were there, whether it was good or bad, even yet, we can still debate it until we're blue in the face. Mm-hmm.
Was there a hand here first? John?
I just wanted to make a point of clarification because it was mm-hmm. a specific question. The protesters, you certainly can have different viewpoints on whether they should have protested or not. And Art's viewpoint of once you break the law, you're going too far is a very legitimate opinion. Mm-hmm. The question, however, they're not protesting the means of propulsion of the submarine. They're not protesting that it is a nuclear submarine rather than a diesel engine. They're protesting that the weapons are nuclear destruction 2,040 times Hiroshima in one submarine, and that it's a first strike weapon when our official defense posture has been defensive weapons up until then. So I think that's a point of clarification.
Too often we hear per se nuclear devices should be eliminated. These same people will go out and climb a fence to stop a generating plant that is making electricity for people to use.
That's a separate issue,
but it's the same people pushing the same thing. No. They say it's nuclear, therefore they shouldn't use it.
Yeah.
It can go bad. Well, so can any other device blow up and go bad and cause people to be hurt. There's no way of preventing that.
There were two hands. First, Jennifer, and then I'll come to you. All right.
Well, I'm not sure if it's been stated or not, but the LCA, Pacific Northwest Synod, voted in 1980. They had amended it to their constitution in support of civil disobedience, and they have guidelines for that. Very clear, you know, that the cause has to be clear and very specific. The person doing it has to be ready to take the consequences. But it's just the church has come out in support of it, mm-hmm. which is a major accomplishment. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Thank you, Jennifer. And
I wonder if we feel that we can trust the military to do the right thing and never use that bomb. I don't.
Mm-hmm. And that comes back to the question up here in the front about matters of church and state and separation between them. And you have your hand up, too.
Well, we're talking about this first strike.
Mm-hmm.
We had the Minutemen in silos all around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And had the capability of doing just what the Trident or the Ohio can do. But they became vulnerable. At least that's the military said. They're vulnerable because the Russians have perfected their missiles so they can destroy them. We want something now that's going to take the place of this that will not be, that they cannot destroy. And we can retaliate, not necessarily use them as a first strike, but we can retaliate. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a reason behind that. I think that's logical.
Mm-hmm. And with your statement previously about separation of church and state, how do you settle that in your own mind? You feel that we can have an opinion and be for the government and support the government now, as you seem to indicate? Or is that a matter for government to decide whether we have such?
Well, I think there's a place for protest, all right.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, we vote for people to go to Congress, and we want to see what they are going to do for us, how they're going to vote back there. Mm-hmm. So we had them endorse certain candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And then after they get back there, we say, hey, I don't like this.
Mm-hmm.
And like the protesters at Bangor, you know, you and me paid for a lot of that damage over there and getting those people corralled and put through the court system.
Mm-hmm.
It's costly.
Mm-hmm. It was costly to the West over there.
And two hands, the yellow and then the white sweater.
Well, I find it difficult to know who to believe. Some of our church leadership is certainly one way and the other. For example,
mm-hmm.
Bishop Hunthausen being at the head of the protest, you know. And then, on the other hand, the Vatican telling this priest who was a member of Congress, you can no longer serve there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It leaves you pretty confused as to what are we
and
supposed to think
uh-huh.
about? What are we supposed to believe?
Uh-huh. First this gentleman, and then you.
Mm-hmm. I think about when we think about the poor percentage of voters here just in this last election,
mm-hmm.
The majority don't vote. I just wonder if even with these protesters, they're not our majority. It'd be interesting to know just within those hundreds that did protest, how many do vote? I'm sure that there's quite a laxity.
They probably even vote on sewer taxes compared with everybody else. They're very angry people.
Uh-huh.
Sewer socialism, I call it.
All right. Thank you for your question. You had your hand up here.
Well, the first issue is that Hunthausen is also in trouble with the Vatican on that issue.
Uh-huh.
Second point is that a lot of Lutheran countries are in a lot of Lutheran churches are located in countries where there is no separation of church and state, like Norway, Sweden, and Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a conflict even some of those, like the bishops in Norway, I read that they thought the king should be dethroned because he accepted abortion. And the bishops are strongly, you know,
mm-hmm.
protesting that. So even in those countries there are conflicts
mm-hmm.
where there is no separation.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
then in West Germany, you have Lutheran churches under communism that are trying to make it.
That's right.
So.
Okay, thank you. There was a hand here, and then I'll come to you, John.
Wouldn't it be nice if everybody said we'll all live according to the golden rule? Nobody wants to pay for tribute. Nobody wants to go and fight. Nobody wants to do any of these things. The leaders majority of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't that settle everything?
It certainly would. It certainly would. But I think Luther was saying too that
we have to start with ourselves.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And that leads, it is hard to know who to believe, as you indicated in the back, which authority to believe. But that indicates to me why we really need each other, and we need to all have input into this and to struggle together. And though we may have different opinions, we can maybe arrive at some conclusion or halfway conclusion out of our faith, which comes out of our faith, and living what Jesus teaches, trying to do that. And John, you had your hand up.
My question is different, and I don't, if there are other people that are still on this, I don't want to inject it and stop that.
Mm-hmm.
But the words that I have in my memory on
mm-hmm.
Luther's two kingdoms, you have not used, and they would be further confusing, further
mm-hmm.
Confusion for me now, but
mm-hmm.
visible and invisible
mm-hmm.
is what I've always heard. And the visible is the left, the temporal
mm-hmm.
authority. The invisible is the kingdom of God. Did he not use that? Is that just
goodness and Tidehi and all the different reading I've done? That particular idea has not come up with the two kingdoms when you talk about, for instance, temporal authority, I don't think he, Luther's own actual writing.
Did he have a further distinction then in the spiritual of the visible church and the invisible church, and that gets confused in people's minds? Is that Lutheran, visible and invisible church?
Well, now Bonhoeffer writes about the hiddenness, the cost of discipleship, the hidden church where one at the same time visible and at the other time hidden, and what that means. And we're hidden, that gets into something else. We're hidden from our own good works so that we don't become prideful
but
about
visible
them.
Visible and invisible is not part of the two kingdoms thing, as far as you know.
No. Okay. In the actual reading.
That's about the first thing I learned in the catechism.
Yeah.
In the large catechism, it's big print about the visible and the invisible.
Okay, I'll go back and look at that again. And those words don't come up in temporal authority, civil disobedience, or the limits to what we need to obey the civil authorities. And that could be a further development of Luther.